Thank you for joining us at the Roundtable.
Brought to you by Community Education Arts, a nonprofit organization based in Noblesville, Indiana.
I'm Alice Kavanagh Scober, President of CE Arts.
And I'm Sarah E. Morin, Secretary of CE Arts. Let's sit down at the Roundtable.
Welcome back to our first NICE workshop for 2020, when we're discussing romances and relationships in the four novels selected this year.
Let's talk about Scarlett and Ashley from...
Oh, God, so dysfunctional. Yes, please start us off with that, yes.
Sure. So, as a reminder, Scarlett O'Hara is our main character, and she, from page one, has the hots for Ashley Wilkes, but she's too late to marry him, even through several, changes in relationships and status. There's a longing between them, but they can't ever really act on
right.
it. They can talk about it, they can dance around it, but they can never really act on it.
Mm-hmm. She's a lot more open about it, though. She, she's a lot more, kiss me now! And he's like, oh, nobility, I can't,
Right. So even though Ashley is, refusing on one level to do anything further, the fact that he won't ever completely say no and shut her down.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, she just blatantly longs for him. That holds both of them back from forming healthy relationships with other people.
Mm-hmm.
Or at least to fully realize those relationships' potentials. Because we mentioned earlier that, Ashley and Melanie, they have an okay relationship, mm-hmm. but I think that had Ashley done a firm I'm not going there with Scarlett.
Mm-hmm.
That could have been a much healthier relationship with his wife earlier.
Yeah. Yeah, I always felt like Melanie got a little short shrifted in that. But I will say, in not really in Ashley's defense in the relationship with Scarlett, because he has no defense, in my opinion, but because you're right, he doesn't just flat out tell her, no, this will never happen. I let you go. I'm setting you free. He never does that until the very, very end. But I will say, though, that I think that, Scarlett's relationships with any male in this book are dysfunctional. I mean, she doesn't have a functional relationship with a single male in this book. So, but her relationship with Ashley is just really, really dysfunctional because she, like you said, they both are living... They both see each other through the lens of fantasy. Hers is from really childhood. She's very, very young when she, gets a crush on the much older Ashley. Again, we're in a situation in these books where the men are older than the women. And she never quite is able to see him for who he really is. It's at the end of the book, she describes to Rhett that it's like she put, the outfit, the knight in shining armor outfit on Ashley, but she never really saw Ashley. She saw the knight in shining armor outfit. And that, I'm paraphrasing, that's not exactly how she describes it to Rhett when she's trying to convince Rhett that she really does love him in spite of her bad behavior all these years, but yeah, she has a terrible relationship with both her first two husbands, her third husband is Rhett, and they have a bad relationship too, so she's very dysfunctional. But the biggest problem that Ashley and Scarlett have is that's sad to me, is that they genuinely could have been really good friends if they'd both put aside, Scarlett for her part, that childlike, crush on him. And I shouldn't say childlike, but young, very young, immature, mm-hmm. immature crush on him. And if Ashley could have gotten over or, put aside his lust for her, because that's really what drives him to not be able to let her go completely emotionally and psychologically, is he just lusts after her. And he can never kind of let that go and let her off the hook. And so she keeps thinking, you know, that he loves her, quote unquote, loves her, when it takes her a very long time to figure out that the love that Ashley had for her is equitable to the relationship that Rhett had with Belle Watling, the prostitute madam, you know? So she does figure it out eventually, but it's a little bit too late for all of them because it's, you know, when Melanie has just died. So very sad. But yeah, very dysfunctional. The whole, I mean, their dysfunction, Ashley and Scarlett, impacts everybody else in the story. It literally harms everyone. And that is just a really bad relationship. I think they should have won first place. Now that I think about it in retrospect, you know.
Yeah, so much of what Margaret Mitchell has written in Gone with the Wind has to do with how self-aware and just aware of other people's true natures the characters are. You know, like Melanie, for example, who always believes the best despite the evidence.
Despite the evidence, that's a good way to put it. Yeah.
Right. And so what we kind of see here, I mean, Rhett is touted as knowing Scarlett much better than any other person. Scarlett, from page one again, it's very clear that she doesn't get Ashley.
No, she doesn't get,
especially that kind of dreamy intellectual side. She does not.
She's impatient with that. She's very impatient with that part of him. And yet that is exactly who he is. And that's the proof that the reader gets from very early on that she doesn't really see him for who he is. He's like a favorite doll or something that she doesn't want to give up, you know? I mean, she really doesn't see him. And that's the perfect example because it is that kind of dreamy nature that suits him so well with Melanie because Melanie physically represents that dream that he has, you know? And Scarlett represents something completely different to Ashley. It's the earthy, lustful, you know, spirited, you know, nature that he doesn't really have, but he you know, has that pull towards her. So, yeah, it's an interesting thing, the relationships in Scarlett's life and how they impact each other throughout
the book. I'd like to talk just, I'm sorry, I interrupted.
No, go ahead.
I'd like to talk just a little bit about the setting, the trauma that these characters are going through during the Civil War, the sacking of the South, and immediately after during Reconstruction, that those acerbate the situation with their relationships. That, you know, Scarlett is clinging to this romantic image as Ashley, as, like you said, a doll. It's like a safety blanket. It's a current security blanket.
Yeah,
and you can kind of see a little bit of the same thing going on with Ashley, and that if this weren't such a traumatic time that they were both living in, maybe they could have let go of it earlier.
Right, especially for Ashley, I think, because the Civil War, the destruction of his family's plantation, Twelve Oaks, that's burnt to the ground, which is why after the war, when he comes home from being a prisoner of war, he finds his wife Melanie and their baby at Tara with Scarlett at her family's home that didn't get burnt because the Yankees used it, blah blah blah. Anyway, my point was that for Ashley, once the war is over, the financial impact of, you know, his world of the Civil War and Reconstruction and everything that's going on for the rest of the book, that affects his relationship with Scarlett as well, because she is the only possibility of him having any money. He goes to work for her against his better judgment. That's one of the scenes in the book where he is trying to get away and be his own man, and he wants to take Melanie and the baby north because he's gotten a job offer in a bank. And under pressure from Melanie and being manipulated by Scarlett, he gives in to them and goes to Atlanta to run one of Scarlett's lumber mills. And that's the end of Ashley trying to be his own man, right? It's all over that. But that wouldn't have happened. That choice wouldn't have been so fraught with everything if the Civil War hadn't happened. Obviously, he would just be living at his plantation, living with Melanie, raising their kid, whatever, you know. So there's so much about the war that impacted the possibilities for him that I think his longing for Scarlett is in many ways tied to a youth a youthful view he had of her as a young woman who suddenly wasn't a child anymore, but was a woman. You know, that's how he sees her. And he thinks she's very alluring that way, physically and everything. So I think they do have the, I think we have behind the scene podcast stuff coming up and in the, and that we've already recorded and more to come that have a lot to do with the impact of what these people go through, the trauma of war in both Little Women and Gone with the Wind, because it's the same war, you know, the Civil War and its aftermath. And although there's not a war in Jane Eyre, there's definitely some trauma going on in that book in many, many ways. And we have a lot to discuss in terms of trauma and how that affects people. So, characters sure. in the book, yeah. So,
In our 8 minutes remaining, mm-hmm. Do we have time to take a quick dive into, you had briefly mentioned that Scarlett's been married multiple times and that none of these relationships were functional. Do we want to briefly touch on Frank Kennedy and Charles Hamilton, her yeah. first two husbands?
Yeah, let's do that. We might end up talking about them in more depth in the podcast later, but yeah, her first husband, Charles Hamilton, is Melanie's brother, older brother, I should say. Scarlett marries him out of spite. Ashley and Melanie get married, and Charles has, you know, fallen in love with the beautiful Scarlett. Charles being very shy, very immature for his age, a very gentle young man. He's very innocent. He falls in love with Scarlett because she just physically looks like the perfect female, you know, southern lady. He just falls in love with her. So she marries him out of spite, and they don't have a very good relationship, and he dies young in the war, but not in battle. And then when she marries Frank, that's a whole podcast. We'll just have to get into that. You know, we'll have to get into that in the podcast. But Frank Kennedy is actually one of her sister's fiancés. So Scarlett has, you know, basically stolen two husbands already, because Charles was engaged to Ashley's sister, India. So that's terrible. But we'll talk more about Scarlett and her bad first two husbands relationships in podcasts. But Spike, I wanted you to have a chance to talk a little bit about the dysfunctional relationships in Dracula. We've got some time for that if you want to.
Oh, thank you. I actually wanted to give a little bit of historical context for the Dracula character. I mean, his relationship with everyone, with the world, yeah. is obviously dysfunctional. And I think it's important to note that Bram Stoker was, surprisingly to me, was a Protestant, Irish Protestant, mm-hmm. and that he probably would have been familiar with the theology of one Cyrus Scofield, who was one of the first figures in Protestant theology to claim that the Antichrist was someone other than the Pope, that the Antichrist might be a literal figure, the literal beast in Revelation that is born into the world, some sort of satanic, evil figure. And I think Dracula is really, in a very literal sense, the Antichrist. He takes in blood that isn't the blood of Christ. Mm-hmm. There is nothing sacrificial about him. There is nothing charitable or giving about him.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the very essence of his life, is that need to take in blood, which you could read as either... you could read that as rape, with the idea of drinking blood and sexuality mm-hmm. being intermingled, or you could take that as spiritual or life force
right.
that he's draining from other people. So he is somebody who takes and is incapable of giving.
Right.
And is kind in that way the polar opposite of the Christ figure, who gives without taking and is able to be the perfect sacrifice.
Mm-hmm.
Dracula really is literally an antichrist figure. He is the complete opposite of that. And I think that A lot of that has to do with this emerging idea of the Antichrist that comes out of Cyrus Schofield in the 1860s.
I agree with that. I think that, I think Bram Stoker was very intentional in how he made Dracula's reactions to the crucifix or a cross throughout the story.
Yeah.
I think it was an intentional thing that he did. It established that in the lore of the vampire, the stake through the heart, the whole thing, you know, is stake through the heart. You know, is visually you get the kind of a similar, like the nails through the hands and feet of Christ.
Stigmata.
You get a similar kind of visceral, anything that is impaling something is a visceral thing you can visualize and feel in your bones when you're reading these descriptions and stuff. And I think that's very true. I did want to say though, but also that when we in future podcasts and stuff, Sarah E. and I have planned to talk about rape and domestic abuses and violence of all kinds. And Dracula plays an important part in those discussions because he is so violent. I mean, he's very charming. He can be very charming. He can be very seductive, but he is a violent monster. And I agree with you that metaphorically and almost literally, he is the epitome of an Antichrist character, I think, for the time that the book was written, definitely.
Yeah, at least the Protestant Antichrist character, because I think Stoker is, in a lot of ways, with the imbibing of literal blood, is referencing, and that obviously, very obviously, being a sin, is in a lot of ways that could be read as an attack on the Catholic Church and the idea of the transubstantiated Eucharist.
Yeah, definitely.
That it's not, to the Catholics, it isn't wine, but is the literal blood of Christ.
Right,
So, I mean, it could be read that way. I'm not saying that was his intent. But
I feel like he was a smart enough man that he probably had, you know, at least knowledge in there. I mean, from the studies that I've done of Bram Stoker and the research that he did about writing this book, he was amazingly thorough, and he like Margaret Mitchell writing Gone with the Wind, amazingingly thorough research. It took her 10 years to write that book, and I have forgotten, I used to know how long it took Bram Stoker to write Dracula, but he researched very thoroughly, including, you know, the geographical places that he wrote about and their cultures and customs and things. And I think that you're absolutely right that he had a lot more knowledge than we could even imagine when we just read the book. If you don't look into his life and what he was doing and you just read the book, you're like, huh, that could be kind of, you know, metaphorical. But I think I think a lot of it was intentional on his part. That's just my take. I do.
And the idea... Dracula, the name, of course, comes from the figure Vlad Tepes in Transylvania, who was called Vlad Draculia. That name, Draculia, actually means the dragon. So, and in a lot of interpretations of the Book of Revelation, the beast is a dragon. So that could have been just a happy coincidence in the imagery, or it could be a very intentional reference to the beast, who is also considered the Antichrist in certain Protestant theologies. So that's just another thought there.
Either way you look at it, it worked, right? So we're about out of time for our session on dysfunctional relationships. I think we have the clear winner being... our wonderfully dysfunctional. I'm not sure. I guess we don't really agree that maybe the Jane and St. John winner from social media is our favorite in our workshop. I think we lean more towards either someone that Scarlett's involved with or someone Dracula's involved with. But we definitely had some wonderfully dysfunctional relationships in these books. Agreed?
Agreed.
All right. Well, let's take a short break, and I'll end this session, and we'll come back to our third workshop session of today, which is going to be on the friend-zoned relationship. Woohoo!
Yay!
So I'll see you guys in just a little bit.
Join us next time as we continue our workshop discussions of the romances and relationships in our four nice books this year.
This has been At the Roundtable with Alice
and Sarah E.
of Community Education Arts.
Our nonprofit organization is based in Noblesville, Indiana. You can find us online at cearts.org. We'd like to thank James Weston for writing our intro music and for his technical savvy.
Join us next time
at the Roundtable.